Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, healthcare and science in the news, debate, dialogue, discussion, and answers, we hope, to your calls and certainly to your emails. So before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. The first email we're going to do today is a follow-up from something that started last week. This from John and Marina. John writes, I truly appreciate your service to the community, and I was looking forward to your look at the issue of PCBs that are the subject of the lawsuit. I was disheartened to hear your take on the issue. You appeared to be incorrectly informed. The lawsuit is about warning the public of the presence of a toxic substance in their food, not a grab for cash. And the reason pharmacies are named in the suit is because PCBs were found in their generic brands. John goes on to reference several articles, one which appeared in the San Jose Mercury News, and it is a quite good article if you're looking for a general background on this story. John continues, I have a degree in chemistry and know that the way the fish oil is purified to omega-3s is by distillation. I haven't done the research, but I expect if some PCBs are found in omega-3s, it is because the boiling point, etc., of the impurities is similar to the boiling points of omega-3s. Another important factor is determining which, if any, fish oil products to take is the environmental consequences to the source of the stock it is taken from. Some companies are more egregious than others. And he references another article, which we're about to talk about. As I said, I really do appreciate your service, and I hope you can find the time in your busy life to consider these two aspects of sourcing omega-3s from fish oil and the potential health and environmental consequences. Well, we did a little background research, Charlie and I, about this, and I came up with a very useful website for what I promised last week, which was to say good sources of fish oil, and surprise, surprise, it's the Environmental Working Group again. These folks are fabulous. They have a wonderful website, and we have posted a link on our website, or I should say it will be posted very soon, that will take you to the Fish Oil Digest, which will give you good sources, their techniques and processes for how they looked at PCBs, mercury, and other persistent organic pollutants in the fish oils and their ratings. And it's a very nice and very thorough evaluation of fish oil sources. So I'm recommending the Environmental Working Group site. I've also posted how fish oil is processed. And this is actually a technical manual for John and other people who are really interested in the mechanism of this, a good site for that. A good detail, I think, to look for is something called molecular distillation. And this is a technology where they distill the fish oil at 250 degrees centigrade under a high vacuum. And that separates it out from the PCBs and the mercury quite effectively. There will still be trace amounts in the fish oil. There's trace amounts in us, okay? There's a lot of persistent organic pollutants, and PCBs are one of the ones we know to be particularly dangerous, especially for side effects. That's why California Proposition 65 limited our exposure. But unfortunately, these materials were used in insulation, electrical insulators, and it's everywhere. It's in the soil now. It's in the water. We're not going to clean this out entirely of the environment. The key, as always, gets back to limiting your ongoing exposure, which is why it's important to look at the fish oil sites. So limiting your ongoing exposure, and even more important than that, it's important that we keep ourselves healthy, provide our bodies with the fuels it needs for detoxification. Our bodies can deal with a limited amount of this stuff. We're designed to be able to do that. But when our system gets overloaded, that's when there's trouble. So, you know those folks up there in the Nordic countries with their saunas? They've got the right idea. You can sweat a lot of this stuff out, and I've become a real fan of saunas and also basically hot and cold alternating showers if you're trying to get rid of stuff or you think you've taken on a toxic burden. We'll do more on detoxification and some simple techniques. And we're not talking IV chelation here, folks. We're talking about stuff that's fairly straightforward and just takes advantage of your own physiology. And we are going to take a call right now from Colette in Santa Cruz. Hello, Colette. Thank you for calling. How are you?
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
How are you today?
Well, fine. I have a question on the last piece of news you just gave me.
Sure.
Would you recommend flaxseed oil then as opposed to fish oil for your omega-3?
Well, the trouble with flaxseed oil, there's two problems. One of which is it goes rancid very easily. So
yeah,
it's very hard to keep. And that's an issue that goes to the fact that it's very oxidizable. The second issue is the omega-3s have to be converted by your body to EPA and DHA. It doesn't come into your system when it comes in as flaxseed as those compounds. And the conversion, you lose about 90% of the omega-3s. So if
in the fish oil or both?
No, when you'd go from flaxseed oil, let's suppose I tell you you need 1,000 milligrams of EPA.
Mm-hmm.
You'd need 10,000 milligrams of flaxseed oil to get there.
Oh, okay.
So it requires a very high volume, and I'm not sure the conversion rates are actually fully there. I don't know, and we'd have to test. So if I've got someone who wants to do it with flaxseed oil, who's vegan or whatever,
mm-hmm.
I recommend that they get testing, that they actually get their omega-3s. The acids can be tested. These fatty acids are available. Labs will do fatty acid testing. They'll give you your ratios. They'll tell you how much trans fat you've got floating around in your blood. So at least they'll give you a snapshot of your current intake.
Well, this was right in line with what I was calling you about, which was blood pressure.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
And omega-3 is one of the things. I'm taking clonidine, 2-milligram tab.
Probably 0.2 milligram.
Or 0.2.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I'm taking 2.5 in the morning, 2.5 at night, and a Kozar in the morning.
Oh, boy.
Now,
I don't like your regimen.
No, neither do I. I want to tell you that I have floaters in my eyes. I have all kinds of side effects I can't even tell you.
Mm.
One of which is that I'm just very weak. I don't feel strong at all. But the reason I'm telling you this is that I was thinking, because I'm having such bad side effects from the medicine that I'm taking,
mm-hmm.
of going on a 90-day regimen of a holistic approach to blood pressure, which is the omega-3s, the minerals, the calcium and everything, because I'm miserable.
Colette, I am so glad you called me.
Oh, good.
Because there's a couple of things that you absolutely need to know before you do this.
Okay.
And one of which is that you can't stop clonidine.
You're kidding.
You can taper it down slowly.
Uh-huh.
And monitoring the patient very carefully. But if you go cold turkey off the clonidine, you could have a stroke.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
You could have a rebound hypertension.
Well, this is what I want to tell you. This medicine is not bringing my blood pressure down. I went into the hospital with pneumonia.
Yeah, hang on a second, honey. Let me just finish the thought.
Oh.
That's okay. You've got to do it gradually. And I would recommend getting off the clonidine. You're going to need to work with a doctor to do it.
Okay.
Now, back to you.
I want to tell you that I went into the hospital with pneumonia. They clocked my blood pressure at 219 over some god-awful number. It was really high.
Mm-hmm.
All this medicine is bringing my blood pressure down to is 180 over some god-awful number. It's not even really working.
Well, it's not working well. So,
that's a lot of medicine, don't you think?
It is. Had you not known prior to your pneumonia that you had hypertension?
Yeah, I knew I did, but I didn't know it was that high. I don't know if it was because I was sick that it was that high. I really didn't know that it was.
Okay.
I thought I was around 157 was the last time I'd had my blood pressure taken, over not a terrible number.
You got to remember those lower numbers, too, hon.
I know, but you know.
Write them down.
It's all garbledygook to me.
No. You've got to educate yourself about this, okay?
Okay.
This is a disease where you have got to educate yourself. You have got to make good choices. I like that you're looking at detoxification, but right now you've got a condition that really needs pharmaceuticals, and what we'd want to do is work carefully with a physician to get you on to better pharmaceuticals, because I try not to use clonidine. Sometimes I'm forced to. It's very effective, and when really high blood pressure, sometimes you have to bite the bullet and use it, but
mm-hmm.
it's got problems, one of which is if you forget and skip a dose, the blood pressure can shoot up. The longer you're on it, the more likely you are to have this rebound hypertension. And I don't like having people on a drug where if they forget to take a dose, it could hurt them.
No.
That's because, you know,
nobody told me
people
this.
Forget a lot. And that's not good. So we got to work on that. Get you switched over to another drug. You need to be checked for what's called secondary hypertension. So you need to be checked for renovascular hypertension, which is where there's a blockage in the artery that goes to the kidney, and the kidney compensates for that by raising the blood pressure because the kidney is starving. The rest of you is suffocating from too much blood pressure, but the kidney is only seeing, let's say, 100 over 50 because of the blockage in the artery coming in.
Okay.
Got to make sure you don't have that. Got to make sure you don't have one of the other causes of very high refractory hypertension. And if you've been walking around with a high blood pressure for a long time, it may take a while before you are in a position to do the natural detoxification thing, because you actually have to keep some blood pressure medication on board to keep you from having a stroke or a heart attack.
Uh-huh.
So you've got to find somebody.
Why do I feel so much better without the medicine?
Well,
I mean, I feel
the
strong
medicine,
and healthy.
Yeah, but you're not. You're strong and healthy, but you're like the guy who's falling off the Empire State Building, and at the 10th floor, he says, "So far, so good."
Okay.
You're not. You're not. You feel that way, but that's just because you haven't hit the bottom yet. But it's very risky, and so that has to be attended to. Do you have health insurance?
No, but I do get my prescriptions. I'm on Medi-Cal.
Okay.
Right now, disability Medi-Cal.
Good.
I'm
so
63.
You've got access. Yeah, so you've got access to health care. You're going to be spending a lot of time at the local, either with the physician who's covering you, and working very carefully to get yourself under control. You're going to need to buy a blood pressure cuff.
I do have one.
And start checking yourself multiple times a day.
Really?
Yes, really.
I guess I better find it.
I guess you better find it. Yeah, you really need to step up to the plate here.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Be
and
more serious about it.
Very, very much so.
Okay.
Okay, so we need to wrap this up, but
okay,
go ahead. One last question.
I just wanted to ask you, the floaters in my eye, the side effects I'm having from my blood pressure medicine.
I don't know that that's a side effect. Floaters, it may be that they occurred at the same time. Could be that the floaters actually represent a small hemorrhage at the back of your eyeball.
I've been to an eye specialist. I don't have anything wrong.
Well, what I'm saying is maybe when you had that really high blood pressure, you could have actually had a little hemorrhage.
Oh, okay.
And that's one of the things we look for, is a shower of floaters.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be a retinal detachment, but it could also happen because of really high blood pressures.
Okay. Well, I don't want to keep you anymore, but thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So in other words, it's associated with her disease. It's a side effect of the disease, but the drug was started for the disease, so it feels like a side effect of the drug. This is called a misattribution error. It's something that we tend to do a lot. We are here, joined in the studio, by the lovely Alex Burke, who is helping me to pledge and pitch, rather. We're going to pitch, and you're going to pledge. Right, Alex?
That's right, yes.
I want to start off by speaking to our podcast listeners. Podcasts are often very polite during pledge drives. We edit out the pledge drives, and so you get the unadulterated programming without really being asked to face the fact that nothing is really free. So this one's going out to the podcast listeners there. You may think that anything that's out there as web content or radio content, as far as that goes, is free. You may believe that public radio stations like KUSP operate largely with federal tax dollars, but that's simply not true. Boy, is that not true. Federal funding accounts for about 10% of our income. And we'd like to think that that's going to be a larger percentage in the next few years, but, you know, we're not holding our breath. 50% of our budget is paid for with listener contributions, donations from people like you. So, folks out there listening to the podcast, I'm talking to you. The success of this station and this program, which is supported largely by the efforts of volunteers, is really depending on your helping us out.
You can do that securely on the web at kusp.org.
I wanted to just wrap up the fish oil story with talking about the importance of being sustainable to the environment. Now, the foods that have the most fish oil are not salmon, which most of us think, but actually sardines and mackerel.
itty-bitty fishies. So that's my recommendation. Try to learn to love sardines. Try to get it as a food. If you are going to consume fish oil supplements, which when I'm using it at a pharmaceutical level is what I ask my patients to do, do some investigation and look for a product that has biological sustainability, that's using small fish. And believe me, the sites that do that will make a big point of that fact because it's a selling point for them. There's a book, I believe, that John sent me talking about this fish called a menhaden, which is like a little herring, about a foot long, and it is a huge part of the ecosystem. It's mainly a filter feeder, which means it's real low on the food chain, and it's very good at making omega-3 fatty acids. And unfortunately, they are being seriously overfished. And we have got to think in terms of being sustainable as we go after this fish oil. We really do need to make sure that we do it in the most sustainable way possible. And that will require a little bit more centralized organization if we're going to do it properly. But until then, besides demanding that our government does legislate and control against overfishing, we also need to vote with our wallets and purchase products that are produced in a biologically sustainable way. We're going to take another email right now. Gerald Cutler in Crescent City writes, piriformis syndrome. To avoid overuse injuries, people that exercise a lot should cross-train. You may remember we talked about piriformis syndrome last week. Swimming is especially good, and the pool here at 6 a.m. seems to be crawling with people with a lot of patients. I guess he means with a lot of health problems or people who look like patients. Gerald goes on to tell us he swims, bicycles, jogs, and walks. He's 55, has no problems. And I loved his last line, I have no medical background, but I have a big mouth with all my wisdom teeth. Let's talk to Lori in Aptos. Hello, Lori. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you. I really benefited from your former advice, and metformin is really helping me out with Syndrome X.
Excellent.
I just recently got recommended to try Deplin and CoQ10, and I have no idea what they do, and it's to help counterbalance some of the side effects, the psych meds that I'm on.
Okay, I'm having trouble with Deplin. Is that a trade name by any chance?
No, Deplin is a prescription. Well, let's see if it is. No, D-E-P-L-I-N. It's a prescription vitamin.
I'm going to draw a blank on the prescription vitamin for
okay.
you, so I can't really help you unless you turn it over and tell me what's in it.
Okay.
And then I can probably help you.
All the bottle says is Deplin.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
On the back, it doesn't give ingredients or anything?
That's correct.
Okay. I think that it's probably a tetramethylfolate.
Does that affect folic acid uptake?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about folic acid. Yes, that it's coming back to me now. It's methylfolate is the actual compound, and it is a trade name. And see, I just needed a hint. That's because I learned all my stuff from multiple choice tests. The idea here is that when you eat folic acid, your body has to convert it, and it goes through a series of steps. One of the steps is a methylation step. This is created by an enzyme called methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase. This enzyme turns
the CH3 on
it's
there?
MTHFR, yeah. And this particular enzyme tends to mutate in humans. And so about 10%, roughly, somewhere between 3 and 10% of the population actually has a bad gene for this and has impaired conversion of folate. Most of these people will have a high homocysteine level if you check their blood for homocysteine.
Mm-hmm.
There's a raging debate right now in medicine about whether homocysteine itself is bad for the blood vessels, or the more conventional view is that it's a marker for a problem. So what we end up with is high homocysteine, high cardiovascular rates, high strokes, high heart attacks. Is the homocysteine doing the damage, or is it just a marker for the problem? Either way, the most strong candidate for what's actually going wrong in the body is a methylation issue related to not making enough methylfolate. So this nutritional substance is jumping the initial enzyme step, the one that's damaged in a lot of people. And if you take that, it drops the homocysteine. It's being used a lot in depression because there is a very important methylation step in the brain. And a lot of people with non-responsive depression will actually turn out to have a problem at this particular enzyme. So we've discovered...
I have had great relief since taking it from bipolar depression.
So you might be one of those individuals and your doctor has properly identified you. That's pretty far advanced. High five to your doctor.
Okay. Well, thanks for explaining that. And is CoQ10 somewhere on your website?
Lots of stuff on CoQ10 if you search the website.
Okay. Just look
at the topics.
Well, thank you kindly.
You're welcome.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now we're going to Lori in Santa Cruz. Hello, Lori, and welcome to the program.
Hey, Dr. Dawn. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you for having such a wonderful program.
Well, you are most welcome.
I have a few questions. I was diagnosed with primary biliary cirrhosis.
Oh, dear.
Not
a good diagnosis. An autoimmune disease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I've never been sick a day in my life, really, so to find this out was a devastating blow.
Did anyone in your family have any autoimmune disease?
Not that I'm aware of, but, you know, I have a sketchy family history.
Okay. Well, first thought I have is get yourself a vitamin D level.
Mm-hmm. It was low.
There's just amazing data on how raising vitamin D levels helps with autoimmune disease.
Good.
Okay, so you want to take a look at that one. And you might want to search, before you go to the immune suppressant drugs that are available, let me ask you, how was this diagnosed? Did you have elevated liver enzymes? Were you ill?
Yeah, a really high alkaline, I think it's called phosphatase level, that was up around 800 and something.
Mm-hmm. Or how are the rest of your liver enzymes?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Are you working with a liver specialist?
No, I went to see a general family doctor.
Do you have a visit with a specialist lined up yet?
No, see, the thing is I don't have health insurance, and I just thought that's going to be a very, very expensive endeavor. So I'm on the Resodiol.
Resodiol?
Taking the medication, like it's another name is Actigal, it's called Resodiol.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
And how are you doing?
Well, the thing is, I'm very thirsty still, have dry eyes, you know, sometimes I'm really itchy. So those are the only symptoms that I've had.
Those are probably related to an elevated bilirubin. Is that also high, or do you not know?
It might have been. I'm not sure about that either.
I suspect that those are probably not from the alkaline phosphatase, but are, in fact, related to the other. So I'm just kind of thinking off the top of my head here and trying.
Well, it's not a common disease. I've heard that only 3 to 15 people per million have it.
It's quite rare.
Yeah, darn it.
Well, yeah, you don't necessarily want to be a happy recipient of a rare disease.
Nope.
No, you don't.
But here's a question I have that the medication is extremely expensive. If I was to buy it through the United States, a month's dose would cost almost $300. I'm supposed to take 1,000 milligrams a day. So my doctor did some research and we got it through Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a 6-week supply for $180 plus postage.
Isn't that ridiculous?
Let's
just take a breath for a moment. What are we, you know, supposedly the largest, richest country in the world? And I hear stories like yours every week, and it just drives me crazy.
It's a shame.
All we need is to use that purchasing power that we've got, and we'd be able to get the drug prices down. I mean, why do we need to subsidize the pharmaceutical companies and the Canadians don't?
Well, it's still high, I think, but the little political game to me, and I'm not sure, I've never had to deal with any of this before. The stuff I'm trying to research has been blowing me away, and I beat the bushes with a stick, and then I come up for a breather, and then I go back. But it comes in different dosages, so I'm taking 250 two times a day, and that's expensive, but the 300 milligram tablets are less than half the price, but they come in a capsule, so it's powder instead of, you know, a compressed pill.
I don't really think that matters very much, and I think you have to just go for the dose. Now, the dosing that
can't get 1,000 milligrams that easily out of 300 milligrams, though.
Well, you know, the dosing range is like 8 to 10 milligrams per kilogram per day. So you take your body weight, and you divide by 2.2, and then you have your kilograms.
Mm-hmm.
And once you have your kilograms, you multiply that by 8, and that's the low end of the dose, and then by 10, and that's the high end of the dose, and you try to hit in there somewhere.
So do you think that I could go on 300 milligrams or buy the capsules and take them apart and make my own 250s, save a bunch of money, and or does it, so you're saying I think that it doesn't have to be a science, the amount I'm taking, as long as I get close to it?
Yes, I'm saying it's all seat-of-the-pants stuff. And,
yeah.
And so you can definitely be seat of the pants on your dosing. This acts to help dissolve bile. So that's its action. It doesn't really get to the root of the autoimmune disease.
Well, it never will it?
No.
I mean, only a liver transplant would do that if it's needed.
Well, no.
Oh.
But I do think that you should be working with someone who's really, really into this particular disease. And there's an excellent center up at Stanford, which is relatively near you. In terms of the funding aspects of it, the first step, I think, would be you may qualify. There may be some grants. They may take care of you in return for signing up for a clinical trial. Because it is a rare disease, you can kind of leverage the rarity. Plus, you've been healthy, so you don't have a lot of confounding variables, so you'd be a perfect guinea pig. They may salivate when they hear about you.
It's, somebody wants me.
Somebody wants you. But I mean, hey, if you can get a scholarship for treatment,
and
go for it. And so you should explore that. And as far as getting funding for your health care, I don't know what your economic situation is.
I kind of fall through the cracks. I think I have a little too much, but, you know, it's not enough.
Well, talk to the local people, the Medicare, Medi-Cal people. Get yourself a denial, but you might qualify for emergency Medi-Cal because of your rare disease status. I mean, this is a life-threatening disease. So I want to wish you the best of luck, and what a blow. But you're on the right track. You've got to educate yourself, both in terms of the disease itself, but also the options.
Mm-hmm.
Do get that vitamin D level.
And you know, my doctor prescribed D and A and K.
But you want to get your vitamin D level up to about 60 to 70 in your bloodstream.
Okay.
And if you have to buy your own blood tests, go online. There are cheap places online that will do blood tests.
Okay.
Life Extension Foundation is one. Consumer blood tests or consumer purchase blood test in a Google search engine will probably turn it up for you. And these labs they're CLIA certified, they're federally monitored, they're good labs.
Good.
But their business model is they sell direct to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
So they know that people are paying out of pocket, and so it's a price war, as opposed to, you know, Blue Cross is leveraging a discount out of Quest, which works for Blue Cross but doesn't work for you.
Exactly. Yeah, so then thank you very much. And how would I get in the door at Stanford? Who do you contact there?
Go to the gastrointestinal department. They probably have a website, and there'll be a subsection for this disease. So you could just search stanford.edu and search your disease, and you'll probably come up with it that way.
Thank you so much. This has been invaluable information. I totally appreciate it.
I am so happy to be able to help in any way.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Let's go to Lucia in Hollister. Lucia, did I get your name right?
No, it's Lucia.
Lucia. Oh, darn. I was hoping to have nailed that. Okay, go ahead.
First, I want to say that we have pretty good health insurance. I feel that my family is very fortunate, you know, to be able to have insurance. And we're able to take care of health needs. Unfortunately, we're always having to fight with them to pay for things that we think, you know, that are part of the plan, but they don't. But I have been lobbying the Congress and the President to reform the healthcare system, because I think everybody needs insurance, like this last caller.
Thank you. I'm glad that you, one of the privileged people who isn't going bare, so to speak, is willing to spend some time helping others. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, I mean, my daughters, my sisters, my brothers, I mean, everybody is having some kind of problem with inadequate health insurance. So, you know, so that we need to do that for everybody. The reason that I'm calling now is my 7-year-old daughter has been complaining. She says that her bones are shaking. I asked her pediatrician, and she was kind of in a hurry. So she said that she thought maybe it's because of her vision that she's feeling that way.
Your daughter has a vision problem?
Yeah, she's considered legally blind.
Why is that? Do you know the reason?
Yeah, but I'd rather not talk about it.
Okay. Well, is it something that could affect other aspects of her health, though?
Other aspects?
Well, in other words, did something happen that is an outside cause, or could this be due to a physiological problem that might affect other body systems?
Well,
Without telling me, I don't want to. I want to respect your privacy, and you don't need to answer that question. But you understand why I've asked it.
Yeah.
Okay. To get back to bone shaking is a weird symptom. So, when did it start? How long has she been complaining about it? Has anything else changed?
Yeah, she's been complaining about this for about 3 weeks now. So what I do is I massage her.
Where?
I don't know what else to do. You know, have some oils and massage.
Where does she have this symptom?
She's in her legs mostly.
Okay.
Her ankles.
That actually is extremely reassuring.
Okay.
Anyway,
so I looked it up on the internet, and of course, there's nothing about.
Oh, never Google. Never Google your symptoms. It's always a bad idea. You'll scare yourself to death.
Yeah, I know. I couldn't find anything about it anyway, and so that muscle shaking, and you know, because sometimes kids can't identify what part of the body.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. And they don't have a lot of language. And I deal with children and adults, and let me tell you, describing an unusual sensation is quite difficult, and figuring out what the person is actually saying is an art in and of itself.
Right.
So if it's lower body, particularly below the knees, in a child in that age, there is something called growing pains, which is very common, typically worse at night. And the main thing to do with that, besides the massage, is a vitamin D level.
Vitamin D,
D, because it can be a sign of vitamin D deficiency. And the bones aren't getting enough calcium in.
Okay.
And so if that's the case, then it can be helped with vitamin D supplementation. If it's just this nebulous thing we call growing pains, use massage, use moist heat, use over-the-counter...
Moist heat.
And over-the-counter analgesics. A good way to apply moist heat, if you don't want to use a hot bath, is to get a heating pad that's designed to be used with a moist pack, and it'll say on the package, and you want to be sure that that stays insulated from the person's body, because you don't want to cause an electrical burn.
Right.
But then you put a moist cloth, like a towel that's been dipped in water, against the skin, and then you put the heating pad on top of that, and that helps the moisture penetrate, and that's very useful for deep pain, both muscle or bone. So hopefully, or rather I should say, I am hopeful that this is a growing pains phenomenon. You have access to care and get the vitamin D level.
Okay. The vitamin D, she takes the multi-children's vitamins. I don't know what the level is of any of the particular vitamins. It's just
It'll be something like 400 maximum. And
yeah, it has 400 here.
Yeah, you have to get a level. You have to get a blood level.
Oh, okay.
You can't just say, oh, well, there it is on the bottle. That means she's getting it. For one thing, you don't know she's absorbing it. Number two, her biological need could be 10 times that. And you won't know unless you look.
Yeah, she is growing very, very quickly.
Get a vitamin D level. It's not that expensive a test.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
All right, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Have a great show.
Bye-bye. And, you know, talking of world community, I have an email here from Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. This is from Mark. Mark writes, my mother and I both have diverticulosis. Mine was found 2 years ago when I had my first colonoscopy at 52, which was good timing because they found a precancerous polyp. Unfortunately, my mother's was discovered because it progressed to diverticulitis, and she had to go to the emergency room because she was having bleeding from the rectum and vomiting. I've had no symptoms. I'm a runner. I eat lots of fiber, vegetables, and fruit. My mother doesn't eat whole grains and now has been told to avoid nuts, seeds, and popcorns. So I have two questions. Most of the articles I've read about diverticulosis have stated that there really isn't any reason to avoid nuts, seeds, and popcorn. And in fact, a high fiber diet is key. Absolutely correct, Mark. The nuts, seeds, and berries thing was old advice. I was taught in medical school to give it. Later on, during a movement which has been going on in medicine in the last 10 years called evidence-based medicine, we've been re-examining some of this. Well, why do we tell people this sorts of advice? And it turns out a lot of what we thought we knew is wrong. That's one of the things that has not borne out by the research. That being said, We are talking about research that is population-based and as such is subject to a little fuzz factor. What I advise people is stay away from things that are the size of an unpopped kernel of popcorn, because that's the size of a diverticula opening. And I figure, you know, don't eat plugs, and that's the size of the plug. If you chew a seed, it's going to be small, it's going to be a paste, it's not going to block your diverticula. But things that size, popcorn and watermelon seeds, are about the only things that I ask people to avoid. And they're both fairly easy to avoid. If you don't scrape the bottom of the popcorn bowl, you can probably eat the popped corn. You just don't want to get the unpopped kernels. And high fiber is really important. Your mom, you write, is already on Metamucil. I would suggest really increasing the amount of fiber, not just Metamucil, but maybe also some oat bran and some wheat bran. She can put the two together and mix them into a porridge and have that for breakfast. You know, maybe add that into oatmeal. That would be a really good way to get extra fiber. Lots of vegetables. And you asked about the heredity of diverticulitis. That was your second question, or diverticulosis rather. I do see a hereditary component. A lot of times you do get it as family histories, particularly when you see it in a person who has low risk, like yourself, a runner who eats a lot of fruits and vegetables. Why do you have diverticulosis? And that's probably your genes. Anybody who eats a highly processed, low-fiber diet is probably at risk, particularly if they're chronically constipated. In other words, it's not primarily a genetic disease in the overall population, but the propensity to develop it can definitely be inherited, and your behavior may help you avoid that, but you have the DNA that allows for it. So you're doing all of the right things. And you also mentioned probiotics. I am at this point unaware of any research looking at probiotics being curative for diverticulosis, but there's lots of research about probiotics helping with constipation, and we do know that constipation is a risk factor for diverticulosis. So even though there may not be a direct effect, I'm very sure that there's an indirect one. Wasn't sure I was going to have time to talk about this, but I'm going to have it after all. This study just published in the British Medical Journal looking at birth control pills and long-term mortality. This is really interesting, folks. They had 40,000 women who were followed for up to 40 years. They started the study back in the 1960s. And hey, because they've got national health, they've got a national database, and they could actually find out what happened to the people. So they had 378,000 women years of observation among never used birth control, compared to something like 800,000 women years among users. And they compared mortality and death rates. What they found was very interesting. Women who had ever used birth control pills had a lower risk of all-cause mortality, but particularly less deaths from cancer of the colon, about a 39% decrease in colon cancer deaths. Also, less cancers of the uterus, less cancers of the ovary, less cardiovascular disease, heart disease, strokes, but, oddly enough, a slightly higher risk of violent death. Now, all of these have been seen in other studies. There are two other major large population studies, one done in the United States and another done at the Oxford Family Planning Contraception Study. Bottom line is that birth control pills don't cause you to be at risk for dying in the long run. They're protective against certain cancers. This study did not find increased rates of death from breast cancer, which is very important because I hear it every week in my practice, but won't birth control give me breast cancer, doctor? And it's like, well, I'm sure you can find a website that will say so, but as near as our science tells us, no. Let's talk to Jan in Santa Cruz. Jan, we've got just a couple minutes.
I appreciate your show, and I quote you often. So I have a question for you. Last evening, I was not tired. I started yawning, and over a period of an hour and a half, I counted approximately 50 yawns every couple of minutes, and I said, what is going on here? I'm not even tired. But when I got home from the meeting, I went to sleep right away.
Mm-hmm.
So That's not normal. I looked around. Nobody else was doing it, so it's just me.
Do you take any serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac or Paxil?
I take Paxil.
Ah, there we are.
You think that causes it?
Absolutely. It exaggerates the tendency to yawn. So when sometimes I see it in people who, they're not even tired. It's 10 in the morning. They feel fine. They got a good night's sleep and they're yawning.
Yes.
Yeah, like that. So it's a drug side effect, not a hideous side effect as side effects go. If you need to be on this agent because of depression, by all means, don't stop taking it.
I'm sorry. No, I'm wrong. Not Paxil.
Ah, what?
The blood thinner.
Oh,
Plavix.
Plavix. Okay, well, that one's not it.
Okay,
That's not a drug side effect for Plavix, although Plavix just recently had a FDA warning come out. Did you know about that one?
I heard that on the news.
Yeah, so...
It said some people.
Right, somewhere between 2 and 15% of the population, depending on which research you look at, lack an active form of an enzyme that's called 2C19. It's one of those detoxification enzymes that we've talked about so many times on the show. So really quickly, there is a genetic test for that, and we will probably start seeing people get this genetic test if they need Plavix, which is going to be a lot of people. So I expect that this is going to be a real windfall for those people with insurance, or rather for the laboratories that serve them. But such is life. In any event, you may have just been tired. It could be a drug side effect, but not if you're not on the drugs. Gee, I thought I had a slam dunk there.
Oh, yeah.
I was feeling so smart. Uh-huh. Darn.
Well, my doctor says that I have to take this the rest of my life to keep my blood thinned out.
Right. You presumably have cardiovascular or cerebrovascular disease.
Well, it's to keep it from happening.
Do you have a stent?
No.
Have you had any kind of heart attack?
I had a TIA.
That's why then. Yeah.
Yes. And so I don't mind that, but is that fatigue and yawning, is that a side effect?
I don't think so. I've had a couple of people who felt really tired on Plavix, but I wasn't sure it was a drug side effect, and it's certainly not a common one.
Oh.
So how long have you been on it?
About 3 years.
No, I don't think so. Maybe you just were really tired. If it keeps up, I would get checked for sleep apnea.
No, I don't have that, but how about low thyroid?
I haven't ever encountered frequent yawning as a direct result of that, but people do feel tired. It wouldn't hurt to check, you know, common things are common.
Right.
You know, it could have just been a fluke.
Yeah, just annoying. And all my friends look at me and say, am I boring you? You know, I'm keeping you awake, things like that. I said, no, I just start yawning and I can't stop.
Well, I'll see if I can find anything about it, but I'm afraid you've kind of exhausted my database on it for the moment.
Okay. All right, I'll just keep yawning.
I guess you'll just have to. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's nothing serious, but I just wondered if there might be a connection. The other things I take, vitamin D, no connection.
No.
And phenylalanine.
Yeah, we're going to have to go. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, thanks for your help, and I'll check it out myself.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to Ask Dr. Dawn, and I will be back next week to give you more information. Until then, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.